Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, December 19th, 2025. We begin with page one with a large story, which is a public service journalism report. It is titled A Fractured System, an investigation into nearly 100 Illinois jail cases shows repeated medical failures that left people injured, suffering, or dead before their cases were heard. And this story is written by Annalisa Trofimuk and Drew Zimmerman. Caged in a cell, Jared Traylor struggled to breathe and cried out for help, pleading that he felt like he was dying. And it turned out his feelings of despair were exactly right. 4 days after his pleas for help started, Traylor died alone in Central Illinois' Tazewell County Jail, and he was 31. Fellow inmates said after Traylor died on August 26, 2017, that they heard him begging for assistance as he gasped for air, according to documents in a federal lawsuit filed by his mother. Sweating profusely, hallucinating, and suffering chest pains, he can be seen on jail surveillance video, which was reviewed by Lee Enterprises reporters, repeatedly pressing a call button for help that never arrived. Traylor paid the price of public indecency charges with a far greater sentence than the law would prescribe. An autopsy showed he died from dysrhythmia, a heart condition medical experts said was related to alcohol and drug use, but exacerbated by dehydration in the jail. If just one person would have listened, maybe things could be different, said Traylor's mother, Lisa Parrish, but instead they chose to turn their heads the other way. Traylor's case reflects a systemic problem. The Lee Enterprises Public Services Journalism Team and the Pantograph spent over a year reviewing nearly 100 Illinois cases like his, revealing a pattern of inconsistent care and gaps in oversight at county jails throughout the state. As part of the investigation, reporters spoke to dozens of family members, advocates, lawmakers, and local law enforcement officials, reviewed inspection records and medical contracts for all of the state's 91 county jails, and toured several facilities throughout the state. Unlike prisons, which house individuals convicted of offenses with sentences greater than 1 year, jails are short-term facilities meant to temporarily detain subjects pre-trial or who are convicted of minor offenses. While many lawsuits filed by inmates for improper treatment are ultimately dismissed, the complaints offer a window into a fractured system in which complex medical needs often far exceed local resources to address them. As a result, some endure suffering, life-altering injury, or death before their case has even gone to trial. Of the roughly 100 cases filed within the last 15 years, Lee Enterprises journalists reviewed, at least 13 people died while in custody, including Michael Carter in the Macon County Jail in 2015, Jared Traylor, the Tazewell County Jail, 2017, Tiffany Rusher, Sangamon County Jail, 2017, David Brown, Woodford County Jail, 2017, Marcus Mays, Will County Jail, 2018, Daylin Key, Macon County Jail, 2019, Alyssa Lindhorst, Madison County Jail, 2020, Blake Lee, the Woodford County Jail, 2021, Eric Peterson, Rock Island Jail, 2022, Kayla Evans, Lake County Jail, 2022, Renata Aguilar Hurtado, DuPage County Jail, 2023, and Michael O'Connor, Cook County Jail, 2023. The problem of preventable deaths of pretrial detainees has grown over time. Nationwide, about 1,200 people died in local jails in 2019, a roughly 33% increase from 2000, according to data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. Of those who died in 2019, about 77% had not been convicted of a crime, and almost 40% of them died a week or less into their detainment. Having handled hundreds of wrongful death cases tied to jails and prisons, attorney Lewis Meyer points to a common theme, a breakdown in communication. Among the staff and medical providers at many facilities, there's either people that just don't care or think the detainees are crying wolf, said Meyer of Chicago-based Meyer and Kiss. A lot of times you can ignore it and the problem goes away and nothing happens, he said. Unfortunately, many times you ignore it and the problem doesn't go away and gets worse. And then I'm getting a call from a grieving family asking me, what happened to my son? What happened to my daughter? County sheriffs and jail administrators say they are doing the best they can with available resources. We have limited capabilities in the corrections setting to provide medical care at some of the levels of individuals that come into us, said Rock Island County Sheriff Darren Hart. The Rock Island County Jail is located in Illinois, near the Iowa border, along the Mississippi River. Even though the jail has access to more mental health services than others, there are still weak spots, Hart said. It is not the level of care that these individuals need, he added. To compensate for a lack of staffing or resources, most counties contract with private health care providers, which is viewed as a more cost-effective and efficient approach than hiring additional county employees. Other facilities turn to nonprofit organizations for care, while some counties rely on their own health departments to meet the growing demand. In the Tazewell County Jail, Trailer's life was in the hands of correctional officers and a company called Correct Care Solutions. It merged with another company in 2018 to become WellPath, which provides health care for hundreds of jails, prisons, and other detention facilities across 37 states. Advanced Correctional Healthcare, another one of the nation's largest jail health care providers, contracts with almost half of the jails in Illinois and more than 350 facilities across 21 states. These companies may administer services, but providing additional staffing can be an uphill battle for them as well. Livingston County recently dropped ACH as their health care provider, with Sheriff Ryan Bohm citing unresolved staffing issues. Multiple other counties across the country have dropped ACH within the last 18 months after finding more cost-effective alternatives. Peoria County Jail Administrator Carmisha Turner said the county rebid for medical services after its contract with ACH expired and chose to move forward with WellPath. While state law outlines some fundamental standards, the quality of care and availability of some services can vary wildly between counties. Meyer, who focuses heavily on litigation in such cases, said this can be true even when two jails have the same care provider. He recalled one example in which two neighboring counties with similar populations had very different ways of treating inmates going through withdrawal from drugs or alcohol. One county had a policy on how to monitor and look for it, Meyer said. The other one did not even have a policy, yet it was the same company working for both of them. The patchwork of providers makes it difficult to enforce and regulate standardized care, and with limited resources and staffing, county jails continue to fill in the gap for roles they are not designed or properly staffed for, such as substance abuse centers, mental health facilities, and hospitals. Former Macon County Jail Director of Nursing Tomika Raymond described the environment of working in a jail similar to that of an emergency room. We see everything from an earache to an STD to a pregnant person to a suicidal person. Raymond said in an interview last year, you have to be able to handle the ever-changing environment. She added that this is one of the factors that makes it difficult to find and retain medical workers. If inmates are not getting the treatment they need, their options are limited. Unless they file an internal complaint with the jail or pursue legal action, most instances of poor care go unreported. Advanced Correctional Health Care President and CEO Jessica Young wrote in an email that the company offers the best quality of health care, and in some cases, they have saved lives and received recognition for doing so. For example, last year, the company awarded its own staff members with 3 overdose revival awards and 1 life-saving award for reviving a detainee with no pulse. However, ACH also has been involved in a number of lawsuits in which they have been accused of improper care. A 2020 lawsuit alleges the company, as part of its pitch to prospective jails, claims to avoid major costs by having detainees with the worst medical emergencies released on their own recognizance or sent somewhere else. The plaintiff in this 2020 case, Nicholas Manning, had been in custody of the Shelby County Jail for 4 days before he was released on his own recognizance and transferred to a local hospital after his health deteriorated from opioid dependency and withdrawal symptoms that went unacknowledged and untreated. Banning's medical expenses after spending 2 months in the hospital would total about $750,000. And when asked about this, Young said the accusation of cost saving is absurd. ACH's contracts are structured so that there is no financial incentive to deny care. We are not responsible for paying for hospitalization or pharmaceuticals, said Young. In fact, poor care results in more lawsuits, which are costly, so we are not motivated to do a bad job. Rather, we encourage both the healthcare and security teams. Unless otherwise expressed in a third-party contract, off-site services such as hospitalization and ambulance transportation typically are covered by the county. For years, Illinois municipalities have experienced a decline in the medical and mental health workforce, as well as the loss of community resources and institutions to treat their most vulnerable populations. At one time, the number of beds available to treat jail inmates with severe mental health problems was in the tens of thousands, and that number now hovers around 1,000. Sheriffs and jail superintendents interviewed for this series say their biggest challenges when it comes to health care are handling inmates with extreme mental health concerns and those who are experiencing opioid and alcohol withdrawal. Many of those officials address the need for a change to the overall system, which includes changes at the state level. I really don't have the ability to fully treat these individuals, said Sangamon County Jail Superintendent Beck, and as a result of that, they are sitting here in limbo, suffering. Roughly 1 year ago, the Sangamon County Jail was holding 10 inmates deemed unfit to stand trial. In total, these inmates had spent 722 days in custody since their evaluation, according to Beck. If an inmate's condition continues to deteriorate, whether they are considered unfit or not, they will be taken to a local hospital for evaluation, he added. Many jails keep track of these medical histories for repeat offenders. In Livingston County, Jail Superintendent Lisa Draper said any questions about an officer's conduct when a subject is arrested is documented and archived in the jail's job management system. If a repeat offender is hospitalized for a mental health condition or is suicidal at the time of the arrest, that will be flagged on the person's file. Young said in an email that the treatment inmates receive in jail is better than what they would get on the street. Many incarcerated people cannot access treatment in the community, are not aware of their medical history, and or don't realize the importance of their current medical condition, Young wrote. In addition, when they come into jail, some are too fearful of catching additional charges to provide the healthcare team with an honest health history, such as substance use. She added that legislation geared toward providing immunity to patients in exchange for honest substance use history would be a major step in the right direction. Parrish, meanwhile, believes her son might still be alive had his life not been in the hands of Correct Care Solutions and Tazewell County Jail. He needed medical attention, she said. If he was on the street and saying, I need help, somebody's going to call 911. He was totally dependent, alone, to take care of his needs. He was not even allowed out to make a phone call to call me. Parrish remembers her son as having a caring heart, even as a child. If you were the kid down at the end of the street that people were making fun of, he was making friends with you, she said. As an adult, Traylor never shied away from helping his mother with anything she needed, from moving her into a new house to helping with any car repairs she needed. The two were very close and bonded over a love of music, she said. Some of their favorite bands to listen to together were AC/DC and the Rolling Stones. I miss my son dearly, she said. I miss seeing his face coming in the door and making me laugh. When Traylor was booked into Tazewell County Jail, he was put into the special housing unit, a cell block for inmates experiencing a range of situations from mental health issues to opioid and alcohol withdrawal. As he suffered symptoms of alcohol withdrawal, including chest pains and hallucinations, a correct care nurse at the jail found that his blood pressure had risen dramatically, according to court documents. Between the three times his blood pressure was recorded and his complaining about chest pains, the staff was aware that there was a need for medical attention. But at no point was Traylor seen by a doctor or transferred to a hospital, court records allege. WellPath's contracts with various counties, including Tazewell, have stipulated that the company is required to identify members of the jail population with medical or mental health conditions, which either could be worsened as a result of being incarcerated or would require extensive care. The sheriff is then informed of these at-risk detainees and must make every effort to have such an inmate released, transferred, or otherwise removed from the correctional setting. After having spent hours trying to get comfortable in jail, around 9:34 a.m. August 26, 2017, Traylor lay down in his cell with his head on a table and his body on the bed. When a nurse and two other correctional staff members arrived at his cell around 10:12 a.m., Traylor was cold to the touch, court records state. An hour and a half later, Illinois State Police officers arrived and took photos of the scene. After his death, Parrish filed a lawsuit on August 24, 2018, against the county and Correct Care Solutions, Incorporated. According to court documents, the jail and medical staff blamed Traylor's death on frequent alcohol and drug use. While those factors were cited as contributing, the autopsy report illustrates that the details surrounding his death are more complex. Dr. Matthew Fox, the forensic pathologist who conducted Traylor's autopsy, said the cause of his death was cardiac dysrhythmia, also known as an irregular heartbeat due to hypertensive cardiovascular disease. Dr. Brian Stubich, an expert witness who reviewed the videos from Traylor's cell and his medical records, stated in his report that Traylor died of preventable causes. He added that the high temperature of the cell due to a lack of proper ventilation or air conditioning contributed to his symptoms. Stubich's report also said that CCS medical jail staff failed to perform proper medical intake, did not have Traylor transported and evaluated due to his initial complaint, did not perform tests for appropriate vital signs, nor take action and address abnormal vital signs such as the elevated blood pressure. Tazewell County agreed to a settlement in November 2020. The claims against Correct Care Solutions were dismissed in their entirety. Everyone needs to realize that they are someone's life, said Parrish. This is someone's brother, friend, father, not just an inmate. They are people, too. For decades, some people booked into Illinois County jails have suffered serious injuries and even death after having underlying medical conditions, mental health problems, or substance abuse disorders go untreated. Marcus Mays, age 30, was in Will County Jail for 11 days when he died after a grand mal seizure in 2018. Jared Traylor, 31, was only in the custody in Tazewell County for 4 days before he died of a heart condition related to prior drug and alcohol use that was exacerbated by dehydration. Alyssa Lindhorst, 28, also spent 4 days in the Madison County Jail before dying of untreated withdrawal symptoms. A year-long investigation by Lee Enterprises' public service journalism team and the Pantograph determined that these preventable deaths are not isolated to a particular jail or region. Between 2000 and 2019, the number of deaths of detainees in the custody of a jail nationwide ranged between 888 and 1,200 annually, according to data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. However, this number may not reflect the total number of deaths of individuals in custody due to changes in federal reporting requirements over the last decade. Many of the lawsuits reviewed can be traced back to correctional or medical staff either ignoring or not identifying the severity of a medical or mental health condition and confirming the proper treatment that should be administered. Ensuring that detainees receive adequate medical and mental health services can be hindered by a lack of standardized health care within jails. These facilities are further handcuffed by a lack of funding and a shortage of qualified staff. And we return now to page one, where our next story is headlined, Data Shows Inflation Slowed to 2.7%, November Numbers Likely Off, Experts Say. This is an Associated Press story, Dateline Washington. U.S. inflation slowed unexpectedly last month, according to data that was delayed and likely distorted by the government shutdown. The Labor Department reported Thursday that its consumer price index rose 2.7% in November from a year earlier. Year-over-year inflation remains well above the Federal Reserve's 2% target, and Americans remain dismayed by the high cost of living. The report was delayed 8 days by the federal government's 43-day shutdown, which also prevented the Labor Department from compiling overall numbers for consumer prices and core inflation in October. Thursday's report gave investors, businesses, and policymakers their first look at the CPI since the September numbers were released on October 24th. Consumer prices rose 3% in September from a year earlier, and forecasters had expected the November CPI to match that year-over-year increase. It's likely a bit distorted, said Diane Swonk, chief economist at the tax and consulting firm KPMG. The good news is that it's cooling. We'll take a win when we can get it. Still, Swonk added, the data is truncated and we just don't know how much of it to trust. By disrupting the economy, especially government contracting, the shutdown may have contributed to a cooling in prices, she said. Energy prices, driven up sharply, sharply higher fuel oil prices, rose 4.2% in November. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, so-called core inflation rose 2.6%, compared with a 3% year-over-year gain in September and the lowest since March 2021. U.S. inflation remains stubbornly high, partly because of President Donald Trump's decision to impose double-digit taxes on imports from almost every country on earth, along with targeted tariffs on specific products like steel, aluminum, and autos. The president's tariffs so far proved less inflationary than economists feared, but they do put upward pressure on prices and complicate matters at the Fed, which is trying to decide whether to keep cutting its benchmark interest rate to support a sputtering job market or whether to hold off until inflationary pressures ease. The central bank last week decided to reduce the rate for the third time this year, but Fed officials signaled that they expect just one cut in 2026. Meanwhile, the number of Americans applying for jobless claims for the week ending December 13th declined by 13,000 to 224,000 from the previous week's 237,000, the Labor Department reported Thursday. That's more than an analyst's forecast of 200,000 new applications. Applications for unemployment aid are viewed as a proxy for layoffs and are close to a real-time indicator of the health of the job market. Earlier this week, the government reported that the U.S. gained a decent 64,000 jobs in November, but lost 105,000 in October as federal workers departed after cutbacks by the Trump administration. The unemployment rate rose to 4.6% last month, the highest since 2021. Trump delivered a politically charged speech Wednesday that aired live during prime time by network television, seeking to pin the blame for economic challenges on Democrats. The speech was a rehash of his recent messaging that has so far been unable to calm public anxiety about the rising cost of groceries, housing, utilities, and other basic goods. As the holiday season approaches, Americans dipping into savings, scouring for bargains, and feeling like the overall economy is sputtering, said a new APNORC poll. The vast majority of U.S. adults say they have noticed higher than usual prices for groceries, electricity, and holiday gifts in recent months, according to the survey from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. About half of Americans say it's harder than usual to afford the things they want to give as holiday gifts, and similar numbers are delaying big purchases or cutting back on non-essential purchases more than they would normally. Trump promised an economic boom, yet inflation has stayed elevated and the job market weakened sharply in the wake of his import taxes. And this story is headlined, Unit 5 OKs Deal for Alert Badges. McLean County Unit 5 faculty members will be equipped with emergency alert badges provided by Raptor Technologies starting January 1. On Wednesday, the Normal-based district's Board of Education approved a contract with the Houston-based company, which has provided school safety services for 7,300 U.S. school districts and more than 60,000 schools globally. Unit 5 Superintendent Kristen Weichel said by using different codes, faculty members can use the badges to discreetly alert school offices and emergency management agencies of any medical emergencies or more serious safety threats. Additionally, the platform will integrate our behavioral threat suicide risk assessments, Weichel said. The district will pay about $177,000 to Raptor for the first year of services and about $165,000 for each subsequent year. Weichel said the district will use the revenue from its 1% facility sales tax to pay for the services since mental health and school safety measures are considered eligible expenses. And here is today's Flick Fact question. So Illinois State University's high-flying football Redbirds first won a playoff game in southeast Louisiana, then traveled on to Fargo, North Dakota, then this past weekend crossed America for a game in Davis, California, and after winning there, this weekend will play Villanova in Philadelphia, capping an exhausting itinerary. But can you think of one unsung entity of a football team that might be especially tired? And the answer is we would suggest it might be Nick Watson, ISU's football equipment manager, whose staff has been orchestrating, through federal companies and a network of liaisons, all the driving of the team's equipment to the various game sites, 789 miles from Normal to southeast Louisiana, and then 1,396 miles to Fargo, then 1,542 miles to Davis, and now from there, 2,803 miles to Philadelphia. That's 6,530 miles in less than a month. Says Nick, anyone doing this and not wanting to succeed every chance they get, regardless of the extra work involved, probably should not work in organized sports. Kudos to an unseen job. Well done. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, December 19th, 2025. I look forward to reading part two with you next.